not in mournful numbers. Life is but an empty dream, for the soul is dead that slumbers, and things are not what they seem. Life is real, life is earnest.
You are listening to the voice of Donald Crisp reading A Psalm of Life by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, a page from this week's edition of Anthology. This is Fleetwood. Each week at this time, the National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with the Poetry Center of the Young Men and Young Women's Hebrew Association in New York, brings you Anthology, a selection of readings from poets, past and present, and the music to accompany their poetry. This week, our guests, by transcription, Donald Crisp and W. H. Auden. That rather special and decidedly happy word, birthday, receives top billing this week since it has a close association with every phase of our program. February 27th, the anniversary of Longfellow's birthday, will be marked by Donald Crisp reading several of the poet's best-loved poems. On February 21st, Random House published W. H. Auden's new book of verse, The Shield of Achilles. February 21st was also Mr. Auden's birthday, and of course, with pardonable pride, we'd like to point out that this is the 52nd edition of Anthology this week. We're 1 year old. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow was born in Portland, Maine on February 27, 1807, of an old New England family. He was, in fact, descended from Priscilla and John Alden, he of the speak-for-yourself fame. Longfellow matriculated at Bowdoin College when he was 15. When he was 20, he went to Europe, where he spent 2 years. Germany was Longfellow's favorite country, and he not only learned the language of the German people, but much of their literature and folklore. In fact, if you'll listen carefully, you'll hear a fascinating German legend mentioned in the first Longfellow poem, which Donald Crisp will read for us. I'm sure you'll recognize, in fact, even remember, many of the familiar lines of The Children's Hour.
Between the dark and the daylight, when the night is beginning to lower, comes a pause in the day's occupations that is known as the children's hour. I hear in the chamber above me the patter of little feet, the sound of a door that is opened, and voices soft and sweet. From my study I see in the lamplight, descending the broad hall stair, grave Alice and laughing Allegra, and Edith with golden hair. A whisper and then a silence. Yet I know by their merry eyes, they are plotting and planning together to take me by surprise. A sudden rush from the stairway, a sudden raid from the hall, by 3 doors left unguarded, they enter my castle wall. They climb up into my turret, or the arms and back of my chair. If I try to escape, they surround me. They seem to be everywhere. They almost devour me with kisses, their arms about me entwined, till I think of the Bishop of Bingen in his mouse tower on the Rhine. Do you think, O blue-eyed banditti, because you have scaled the wall, such an old moustache as I am is not a match for you all? I have you fast in my fortress, and will not let you depart, but put you down into the dungeon in the round tower of my heart. And there will I keep you forever, yes, forever and a day, till the walls shall crumble to ruin and molder in dust away.
The lines, which are based on the German legend I mentioned, are contained in the verse, "They almost devour me with kisses, their arms about me entwine, till I think of the Bishop of Bingen in his mouse tower on the Rhine." According to the German storytellers, in the 10th century there was a great famine throughout the land, but when the poor people came to a certain Bishop Hatto for food, he refused to help them because they reminded him of a horde of rodents devouring anything they could find. After the famine was over, the legend relates that hundreds of mice suddenly appeared in the town in which the bishop lived. Frightened by their great numbers, he retreated to his tower on the Rhine River, but the army of mice swarmed across the stream, gnawed through the bolted doors, and devoured the cruel prelate. Robert Southey has told the story with vivid realism in his poem, God's Judgment on a Wicked Bishop. But Longfellow refers to the legend in a teasing, kinder vein as he is almost devoured by his children's kisses. The poetry of Longfellow is filled with lines which are today common language. Life is real, life is earnest. Into each life some rain must fall. Suppose we listen to Donald Crisp read the poems from which these expressions originated. First, a psalm of life, and then the rainy day.
Tell me not in mournful numbers, life is but an empty dream. For the soul is dead that slumbers, and things are not what they seem. Life is real, life is earnest, and the grave is not its goal. Dust thou art, to dust returnest, was not spoken of the soul. Not enjoyment and not sorrow is our destined end or way, but to act that each tomorrow find us farther than today. Art is long, and time is fleeting, and our hearts, though stout and brave, still like muffled drums are beating funeral marches to the grave. In the world's broad field of battle, in the bivouac of life, be not like dumb driven cattle, be a hero in the strife. Trust no future howe'er pleasant, let the dead past bury its dead, act in the living present, heart within and God o'erhead. Lives of great men all remind us, we can make our lives sublime, and departing leave behind us footprints on the sands of time. Footprints that perhaps another, sailing o'er life's solemn main, a forlorn and shipwrecked brother, seeing shall take heart again. Let us then be up and doing, with a heart for any fate, still achieving, still pursuing, learn to labor and to wait. The day is cold and dark and dreary. It rains and the wind is never weary. The vine still clings to the mouldering wall, but at every gust the dead leaves fall, and the day is dark and dreary. My life is cold and dark and dreary. It rains and the wind is never weary. My thoughts still cling to the mouldering past, but the hopes of youth fall thick in the blast, and the days are dark and dreary. Be still, said heart, and cease repining. Behind the clouds is the sun still shining. Thy fate is the common fate of all. Into each life some rain must fall. Some days must be dark and dreary.
We'll conclude our selection of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's poetry with his delicate and familiar poem in praise of the hours of darkness. Donald Crisp reads Hymn to the Night.
I heard the trailing garments of the night sweep through her marble halls. I saw her sable skirts all fringed with light from the celestial wall. I felt her presence by its spell of might stoop o'er me from above, the calm, majestic presence of the night, as of the one I love. I heard the sounds of sorrow and delight, the manifold, soft chimes that fill the haunted chambers of the night like some old poet's rhymes. From the cool cisterns of the midnight air, my spirit drank repose. The fountain of perpetual peace flows there. From those deep cisterns flows. O holy night, from thee I learn to bear what man has borne before. Thou layest thy finger on the lips of care, and they complain no more. Peace, peace or rest is like I breathe this prayer. Descend with broad-winged flight, the welcome, the thrice prayed for, the most fair, the best beloved night.
In commemoration of his birthday, February 27th, 1809, the poems of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, read by Donald Crisp. This past Monday, the 21st of February, a lot of things happened. It was the birthday of Mr. W. H. Auden, and on his birthday, I suppose as a kind of birthday present, would you say, Mr. Auden?
Yes, it was. It's also Mr. Sasha Geetry's birthday, I believe.
Well, I didn't quite say what happened on that day yet, besides your birthday, but your new book, The Shield of Achilles, came out.
Yes, it did.
Which is the cause for rejoicing among poetry readers for this week and many weeks to come, and months and years, conceivably. One of the things that Mr. Auden has agreed to do for us today is to answer some of the questions which listeners have written in. We're always getting...
I won't say I'll answer them. I'll try.
I'm sure you're an expert at answering questions because you've spent a good many years touring throughout this country and England and where else?
Well, I'm an old ham schoolteacher. I've taught for many years anyway, so I'm used to questions.
You're never at a loss for some kind of answer, in other words.
No, never.
Or if you are, I presume you'll know how to turn us away.
I know how to hide it.
Here's the first one. Do you believe there's a renaissance in America of poetry reading?
Yes, undoubtedly. There's much more readings of poetry going on, which poets actually paid for, I'm sure, than there was, should we say, 20 years ago. It's not even only in poetry. You notice how people can spend a whole evening reading works of Dickens or something. Mm-hmm. People do appear to be interested in the spoken word now, which is very nice for us.
Aside from the poets reading their poetry, do you think people are reading aloud at home more? Do you?
That I don't know. Uh-huh. I know some parents think it's important to read aloud to their children, but whether there's actually much more, I don't know.
I suppose it's pretty difficult to tear the kids away from the television set to get
them to listen to poetry. I imagine so, yes.
But there's more on television or radio.
Yes, there is, yes.
Yeah. Here's our second question. Sounds like a quiz show, doesn't it?
Does.
What chance has the young poet today, and how can he begin to have his works marketed?
That is a problem, because the actual expense of publishing books, of course, has gone up a great deal, so that publishers hesitate to risk money on something which will not make money, because poetry never does make much. You start, I suppose, with the magazines. They are starting with some of these pocketbooks in printing the work of new writers. There have been several, that New World Writing, for example, where they do print the work of new writers, and so something is being done.
Here's question three. William Carlos Williams considers the poet a prophet. What do you feel his position is in the world today?
Oh. Now, that's a rather hard one. I would hesitate to say that poets are prophets. They may sometimes be some kind of prophet, but I think it would be awfully difficult to start by thinking I'm going to be a prophet. I mean, what you do is really try and give some people some pleasure by what you write. If in addition to that you make them any wise or something, well, so far, so much the better. But it certainly is not a thing a poet should think about.
In other words,
he should think about making a thing properly and as best as he can.
In other words, if he happens to be a poet and a prophet, too, well,
no,
okay.
Sir, fine, yes.
But if he's not a prophet, he shouldn't go around worrying about it.
No.
And write poetry anyway. Let's see, this is question number four. And we don't have any $64 to offer for it either.
Shame.
What do you look for in modern poetry? I guess we should say, what do you look for in modern poetry? Or no, maybe what do we all look for? If you have no understanding of what the poet is trying to say, how do you find that understanding? Obviously, this you does not mean you, Mr. Walter.
Yeah. Well, obviously, if you said you can't understand anything, I don't know how you would begin except by just rereading. I think there is a certain thing that should be said, because this question comes up so often, about whether modern poetry is obscure or not. Firstly, that to imagine that difficult poetry is an invention of this age is just not true. If you want to see what really difficult poetry can be, you should have a look at the Scandinavian court poetry of the 10th century, which is incredibly difficult. The other thing I would say is that one element in poetry, it's not the only element, but one element, I believe, is the riddle. Now, everyone really enjoys solving riddles. Look, otherwise, people would not do crossword puzzles. And the difference between what you might call legitimate difficulty and illegitimate obscurity would be very much the same as it is in a crossword puzzle. When 1 week you cannot get something, right, you look next week. If you say, my God, what a fool I was, I ought to have got that clue, well, that's all right. If you say, no, it was unfair, I couldn't get it. And roughly, it's very much the same, I think, in poetry.
Let's see what question number five is. What has happened to poetic drama? Why are so few verse plays written?
Oh. I think that maybe that the tradition of how to speak verse has disappeared. And it has to compete with other forms of drama. And, of course, it's a terribly expensive medium now.
Do you find this is as true in England as it is in this country?
Pretty well, I think.
Really? Because you always look upon the British actors, for instance, as being able to do...
I think they can, maybe, but I don't really... I think it's partly simply a matter of the expense of the medium.
To put on any play, verse drama or straightforward prose is still a great risk and very expensive. And, of course, since the verse drama is apt to be more obscure and draw less people, I suppose that immediately cuts down.
Actually, I know what people, a number of poets, are becoming interested in, as I am now, is librettos for operas.
Uh-huh.
Which, of course, is a form of poetic drama, if you like.
Sure. One of the great forms, isn't it? Let's see. Question number six. Can repetition harm a poem? Some listeners write in and ask to hear the same poem again and again. They consider a poem the same as a musical composition.
They're quite right. Ideally, you should know a poem by heart. I always, when I have classes, I make people learn large quantities of poetry by heart without explaining what it's about. Just make them learn it.
I agree with that. We had to learn poetry by heart, even in college, and I remember the kids thought, oh, this is child stuff, you know. But I still remember some of the poems.
And after it, first of all, they think you're mad. But afterwards, they're grateful.
Yes, I was grateful. Now, I'll never forget the professor who taught me those poems. Number seven, should you read poetry aloud to yourself?
Yes. Because all poetry, even if it's difficult, is meant to be heard. The difficulty, obviously, of listening to somebody reading aloud a poem they never heard before is like listening to a modern piece of music, too. That you have to know it well before you see the beginning, middle, and end. I mean, it's the same thing. But in the end, it should be read aloud, certainly.
Question eight. Where should poetry appreciation start? What should the novice do? If you sincerely have the desire to learn about poetry, where do you begin?
You just read it. That's all. I mean, There's nothing else you can say. If you're interested, you read it, study it.
But you don't think there's any particular type they should start off with? Just plunge?
Yeah, they must form their own taste. Mm-hmm. And just read what they find interests them. And I think one of the great differences you'll see between somebody who really is going to be a poet and somebody who's just going to like the art is the thing that the person who's going to be a poet will look at all the time is technically how the thing is made.
That completes the questions that we picked out for you today.
Oh, well, just as well.
But I'd like to read just a sentence here from Dorothy Kilgallen's column in the Journal American for February 22nd. She says, "The ultimate has been reached in the do-it-yourself rage. Now you can buy a do-it-yourself poetry kit which enabled you to write in the style of any of 15 famous bards, and it sells for $1 in Greenwich Village."
Mercy. I would like to see it. But how awful it will be if it turns out to work.
We'll have more poetry than we know what to do with.
We shall, indeed.
This may be the birth of a new age.
Exactly. It's terrifying to think of.
Maybe when you read the poem, you'll find yourself branching out into new kinds of poetry yourself.
Exactly.
Well, why don't we branch out right now and have you read some of W.H. Auden's poetry?
Now let me see.
From your new book, The Shield of Achilles.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I start with something very simple, which is just an epitaph for a white cat of mine, which is buried in Italy. "At peace under this mandarin, sleep, Lucina, blue-eyed queen of white cats. For you the Ischian wave shall weep, when we who now miss you are American dust, unsteeped pepper mayo in peace and war, augustly a grave watch keep." This is a poem really in favor of a forestry service. It's called Woods. "Sylvan meant savage in those primal woods Piero di Cosimo so loved to draw, where nudes, bears, lions, sows with women's heads mounted and murdered and ate each other raw, nor thought the lightning-kindled bush to tame, but flabbergasted, fled the useful flame. Reduced to patches owned by hunting squires of villages with ovens and stocks, they whispered still of most unsocial fires. Though crown and mitre warned their silly flocks, the pasture's humdrum rhythms to approve and to abhor the license of the grove. Guilty intention still looks for a hotel that wants no details and surrenders none. A wood is that, and throws in charm as well. And many a semi-innocent, undone, has blamed its nightingales who round the deed sang with such sweetness of a happy greed. Those birds, of course, did nothing of the sort. And as for sylvan nature, if you take a snapshot at a picnic, oh, how short and lower orders is a gang will look by those vast lives that never took another, and are not scared of gods, ghosts, or stepmother. Among these coffins of its by-and-by, the public can, it cannot on a coast, bridle its skirt and bargain-chasing eye. And where should an austere philologist relax but in the very world of shade from which the matter of his field was made? Old sounds re-educate an ear grown coarse, as Pan's green father suddenly raps out a burst of undecipherable morse, and cuckoos mock in Welsh, and doves create in rustic English, over all they do to rear their modern family of two. Now here, now there, some loosened element, a fruit in vigor or a dying leaf, utters its private idiom for descent, and late man, listening through his latter grief, hears close or far the oldest of his joys, exactly as it was, the water noise. A well-kempt forest begs Our Lady's grace. Someone is not disgusted, or at least is laying bets upon the human race, retaining enough decency to last. The trees encountered on a country stroll reveal a lot about that country's soul. A small grove massacred to the last ash, an oak with heart rot, give away the show. This great society is going smash. They cannot fool us with how fast they go, how much they cost each other and the gods. A culture is no better than its woods. Well, there's the very little one, really about a railroad train. Self-drivers may curse their luck, stuck on newfangled trails, but the good old train will jog to the dogma of its rails, and steam so straight ahead that I cannot be led astray by tempting scenes which occur along any permanent way. Intriguing dales escape into hills of the shape I like, though where I actually put, where a footpath leaves the pike, for some steep romantic spot, I should ask what chance there is of at least a $10 check or a family peck of a kiss. But, forcibly held to my tracks, I can safely relax and dream of a love and a livelihood to fit that wood or stream. And what could be greater fun, once one has chosen and paid, than the inexpensive delight of a choice one might have made? This is a lyric called The Willow Wren and the Stare. A starling and a willow wren on a may tree by a weir saw them meet and heard him say, "Dearest, my dear, more lively than his waters chortling as they leap the dam, my sweetest duck, my precious goose, my white lascivious lamb." With a smile she listened to him, talking to her there. "What does he want?" said the willow wren. "Much too much," said the stare. "Forgive these loves who dwell in me, these brats of greed and fear, the honking bottom-pinching clown, the snivelling sonneteer, that so between us, even these who till the grave are mine, for all they fall so short of may, dear heart, be still a sign." With a smile she closed her eyes. Silent she lay there. "Does he mean what he says?" said the willow wren. "Some of it," said the stare. Hark, wild robin winds his horn, and as his notes require, now our laughter-loving spirits must in awe retire, and let their kinder partners, speechless with desire, go in their holy selfishness, unpunny to the fire. Smiling silently she threw her arms about him there. "Is it only that?" said the willow wren. "It's that as well," said the stare. Waking in her arms, he cried, utterly content, "I have heard the high good noises, promoted for an instant, stood upon the shining outskirts of that joy I thank for you, my dog, and every goody. There on the grass bank, she laughed, he laughed, they laughed together. Then they ate and drank." "Did he know what he meant?" said the willow wren. "God only knows," said the stare.
Mr. Auden, thank you very much for being our guest today, and please come back again soon. You've been listening to W.H. Auden reading from his new book, The Shield of Achilles, published by Random House on February 21st. Next week on Anthology, a program of verse we call My Heart's in the Highlands, a delightful selection of Scottish border ballads read by James.